Welcome back to Behind the Play. My name is Alex Adams, and today I'm joined for the second time from someone I really admire who covers the Edmonton Oilers inside and out, the one and only Daniel Nugent Bowman of The Athletic. Thanks so much for taking the time and coming on this show. I think last time we spoke, the Oilers were about to kick off their playoff run, and here we are again, with a couple games left in the season. Does it feel any different from years prior with this team?
Well, first of all, it's good to be back with you, Alex, and repeat guest. I'll have to make the first one better than the last, but I do remember sitting in my hotel in Vegas talking to you, and they had won. I think it was just the series was just about to get going, or maybe game one had happened. So they obviously had gotten they'd beaten the Kings. There's a lot of optimism about that series, a lot of intrigue about that series because it was such a unique matchup, a matchup that a lot of people were talking about, and a lot of people thought the winner of that could go on to win the Stanley Cup, which ultimately happened. For the second year in a row, the Oilers ended up losing to the eventual Stanley Cup champion. So I think there's some kind of there's a lot of similarities to this team in terms of kind of what they have gone through and dealt with in the past. I mean, this is a team that's played in five series the last 2 years. Again, they've lost to the cup champs in each of the last 2 years. You know, a team that is pretty hungry to get over the hump. And obviously, since they had their terrible start going, 9-2-1, I believe, out of the gate, they got an extra win before they fired Jay Woodcroft. But they've been the best team in the NHL since that time. So they, obviously a little bit of a blip over the weekend against Toronto and Ottawa, but certainly a team that is kind of heading in the right direction, a team that, although not perfect by any means, has not only the high end talent, but certainly better depth, I think, than they've had in previous years. So they should be on anyone's short list of a true Stanley Cup contender. Whether or not they can get over the hump, playoffs is a lot of injuries and matchups and your goaltender getting hot, things of that nature. The West is also an incredibly tough conference this year, but I think the Oilers have just as good a chance as anyone, given the roster they have, where they are in their kind of their timeline and the kind of the past. I don't want to call them failures, but not being able to get over the hump in the past that should serve them well this spring.
And now, when you think about 50 goal scorers in the Oilers, you think of Draisaitl and McDavid. And now we have Zach Hyman. And you wrote a really good piece, or a great piece, about him being maybe the most unlikeliest player ever to get 50 goals in NHL history. Maybe make the case for that. And what's been the key to Zach Hyman's success and just becoming a 50 goal scorer after coming to Edmonton? And I think his career high was 21 before he got to Edmonton.
Yeah, I mean, with Zach, I mean, you can certainly look at a lot of different scorers, guys that have scored 50 goals. I mean, Jonathan Chychrun comes to mind. It's like that came out of nowhere. He got benefited from a trade partway through that year that put Joe Thornton on his line, and Joe Thornton won the Art Ross that year. One of the greatest passes ever. I mean, there's some examples of guys scoring 50 goals where you think, oh, really? But in Zach Hyman's case, I mean, he's one of, I wish I had the story right in front of me, but I think it's a 11 or a dozen players in the history of the game to score 50 goals rather at age 31 or older. He's one of eight guys in the fifth round or later in terms of his draft status to score 50 goals. Then, yes, to your point, this is a guy that hadn't really had a proven track record of scoring goals. 21 was a career best before he signed with the Oilers in the summer of 2021. He then had 27 in his first year and 36 last year. I mean, 36 is certainly a great number, a respectable number in this league, but it's nowhere close to 50. And for him to get to this point, given that and all the factors I mentioned earlier, it makes him, I think, if not the most unlikely 50 goal scorer in the league's history, then certainly right up there in a select few. How is he doing it? Well, and the easy answer is, oh, he plays with Connor McDavid. Connor McDavid's the best player in the league and certainly one of the best passers. And McDavid's about to hit 100 assists this year, which only three other guys have ever done. And you might have heard of them. Their names are Gretzky, Lemieux, and Orr. So I mean, that's a good player. But I think that there's more to it than that. I mean, Hyman's a guy that came into this league, obviously, as a very unheralded player. Again, fifth round pick in 2010. People knocked his skating. People thought he was nothing but a hard worker, a complimentary player. And obviously, when you're playing with Connor McDavid, you're not the primary focus on a line. But he's learned over the years to kind of adapt his game and be a scorer. He got his start in Toronto, playing next to Auston Matthews and usually William Nylander. And his job was to go dig out pucks, stand in front of the net, provide screens. He learned kind of that being a screen is good, if being a screen is helpful, but it's not, especially as McDavid likes to wheel around the zone and he can deke out a player or whatever. He's not really giving that player an outlet, or providing another option, or being a decoy, or any of those types of things. And he's learned to kind of do that. And playing with McDavid as much as he has, and he's played about 1,000 of his 1,300 minutes with McDavid in all situations. I mean, yeah, McDavid's going to help him a lot, but Zach Hyman's learned how to adapt and how to read off Connor McDavid too. So certainly, you don't become a 50 goal scorer just because you're playing with Connor McDavid. I mean, the Oilers once upon a time signed Milan Lucic to be that guy, and we all know how that turned out, right? So you need to hold up your end of the bargain if you're going to play with a player of that caliber. And little by little, over these last couple of years, now into year three, Zach Hyman's just continually gotten better. But it still makes him a pretty unlikely 50 goal scorer when you look at all the factors at play here.
How much do you think his goal scoring prowess can translate into the playoffs? Just with he's on pace for 55, maybe even 60 goals this year. But do you think that the way he's scoring is transferable to playoff time?
Absolutely. I mean, maybe not at this rate because we know how much harder it is to score in the playoffs. But he's had, I think last year, I don't have the stats right in front of me. But last year, he suffered an injury early on in the Vegas series. I think it was hit by Nick Hague. That slowed him down a little bit, but had been producing, I think, well enough to that point. Certainly had a very good playoffs as the team did going to the conference final in 2022. And we didn't know how goals are scored typically in the playoffs. It's right around the net, deflections, some that don't look all that pretty. And that's Zach Hyman's game. I'm trying to think of the last two goals he scored, but before, when he was on 48 heading into the weekend, it was 39 of them were scored either right at in the blue paint or just outside it at the front of the net. And I mean, that's where goal scorers go to score goals, especially if you don't have an Auston Matthews or Alex Ovechkin type of shot. So Hyman knows where to go. He knows what to do. And those goals come in abundance because of it. Obviously, the 50th goal was a Zach Hyman goal. Like, and it speaks again to goes to the front of the net, but then he sees McDavid wheeling and he slides to the side to give him that outlet and has an easy tap in that theoretically you and I could score, but you got to get there. You got to know what to do and you got to know what the playmaker is going to do. And that's where Zach Hyman is a little bit better than a lot of people.
It's interesting. I was talking to Jacob Bernard Docker at Sens practice today just about Hyman. He's just going on and on about how smart a player he is, right? And then you talk about being in the right positions at the right time, and that's really what JBD said. And he kind of reiterated what you said about not everyone can score with Connor McDavid. Look at Milan Lucic and other line mates, right? So cool testament to him. And it sounds like he's a pretty A plus guy, so really happy for the guy. And I want to transition maybe from the greatness of Zach Hyman to maybe the greatness of this team under Chris Knobloch. What have you seen differently since he's taken charge? Is it schematically? Is it just getting more saves? What have you seen in terms of the difference in this team's play since he's taken over?
Well, I'll start by sounding like I'm discrediting Chris Knobloch and his staff at first, and I'll get to the credit. But at first, this team was never going to be this bad. And under Jay Woodcroft, they had a lot of bad luck, quite frankly. I mean, their save percentage at 5-on-5 was either the lowest or second lowest in the league. Same with their shooting percentage, either second or lowest or lowest. And I quoted those stats all the time around the firing. I'm kind of blanking, but they were a bottom team in both those regards. Stuart Skinner was second in the Calder Trophy voting last year. He had a 9-14 save percentage, I believe, last year, and the playoffs were a little up and down, but he was never going to be a It was he was his ace percentage save percentage was at like eight in the 850s, 860s. So that was never going to be the case for that much longer. When you have McDavid and Hyman and Leon Draisaitl and Ryan Nugent-Hopkins and Evander Kane and even guys like Warren Fogle, who started the year very, very, very well, and Ryan McLeod, who didn't start very well, they had a And that's those are just obviously the forwards. I mean, Evan Bouchard, I pegged as somebody being as a top three, top five scorer defenseman from the start of the year, and he certainly is right up there. That team is never going to be that bad offensively. So there are those kind of factors too. You had McDavid getting hurt. Unbelievably, he had 10 points in his first 10 games, and being out the team's first 12 games with him being out for a couple. Like those, I mean, a lot of players would take that point per game kind of pace, but not that's not good enough for Connor McDavid. I mean, Leon Draisaitl struggled. They weren't playing well. I mean, and but there was also kind of the issues of the penalty kill. Like they were right near the bottom of the standings during that time of year. They were allowing way too many rush chances against. So those rush chances. Well, a lot of them are ending up in the back of the net, so maybe the goaltender needs to make a save there, but they're also putting their goaltenders in a pretty tricky position early on in the year. So I think that was a key area of emphasis when Chris Knobloch was hired to kind of eliminate those rush chances or reduce them at least. They did a very good job of that early on. They improved the penalty kill where a couple facets were at play there. They turned it over to Mark Stewart, a former NHL defenseman who was on the staff already, but Dave Manson had that role. He was let go along with Jay Woodcroft. One thing they did on the penalty kill was, the Oilers were using almost every forward on the penalty kill in some degree, some more than others. But they really limited it to about six guys, three sets of two penalty killing forwards, and there was a lot more continuity, a lot more buy-in from that group. Those guys predominantly in the bottom six, aside from Ryan Nugent-Hopkins, were getting, not primo minutes, but minutes that were very important to a team's success. Instead of having a lot of guys in the top six do it, and those guys kind of getting left on the vine, so those things really helped their cause rather. And then that puck luck just started picking up. Like again, the team was never going to be that bad. So it was kind of mid November where things really turned. That's obviously when Knobloch was hired, and they had a little bit of a dip, and then they beat Washington coming out of American Thanksgiving 5-0, just a one-sided game where that really the worm really turned then. And they had an 8-game winning streak this year. They had obviously the 16-game one that got close to the NHL record leading into the All-Star break, and a team that I think that the bottom end, like the Western Conference, is pretty poor. So I don't think they were ever in real dire straits to be a team that missed the playoffs. But that stretch in late November into December, and then after Christmas, has really kind of turned this team around.
From afar and looking at their goals against, it seems like they're winning games more in the 3-2 fashion rather than maybe last year where they were winning a bunch of 5-4 and 4-3 games. In your opinion, is this team maybe how much more equipped are they for the playoff brand of hockey and to win tight checking games than maybe in of years past?
It's an interesting question, and I think we're going to kind of dive or delve into that a little bit more in the weeks to come, and certainly we'll see what happens in the playoffs. I think you're right, you make a good point, and the numbers bear that out, that they've been a bit more defensively conscious, I think, than in past years. During that 16 game winning streak, I think it was like 11 or 12 of those last games, might have been up to 14. My memory's blanking, but they were allowed two or fewer goals against, which was a team record. And certainly, that's how you win. That's how you win, obviously you need to outscore the other team, but you need to, limit the other team's offense as well. Now, during that time, I think the Oilers got a little bit discredited by the fact that they were playing a lot of weak teams during that point, and they came out of the break, struggling a bit. I think it was kind of reversed for about 9 or 10 games where they were allowing three or more. So they've kind of defensively had their lapses and moments of setbacks and things of that nature. But I think, again, it's the same defensive core that kind of really, I would say, fell apart during the Vegas series. I think I think they're better equipped. Are they a defenseman short? I mean, maybe. I think you probably like an upgrade on the right side of the top four. But I think, they're a better defensive group overall. And I mean, they still have the offensive firepower to obviously get it done. Their power play still elite. The McDavid Hyman combination at one is one aspect of the offense, but the way Leon Draisaitl has, he's mostly been the second line center, and he can carry, and that's maybe not the a fair word, but he's bringing along two wingers that aren't kind of at Zach Hyman's level, and most recently that's been Ryan McLeod and Warren Fogle. And Fogle, I mean, he was fourth on the team in 5-on-5 scoring ahead of Nugent Hopkins and Kane. So again, he's had a very good year. So I think there are just more pieces, more players that feel invested in kind of what's going on and have more defined roles. I mean, I think they're a better defensive team. The one thing that kind of does worry me is, are they a defenseman short? And I think that's where I think we'll kind of get, we'll find that out in the playoffs. But I do think that they are better equipped than they have been in years past.
If they are to, find a way to make the Stanley Cup Finals, maybe when, even win the Cup, is their template almost the 2017 Pittsburgh Penguins in terms of decor that might not have any superstars, but they have some pretty awesome forwards and good goaltending?
Now I can't remember one of those years the Penguins won without Letang.
Yeah,
So
that's the year.
Letang is a
That's the
this
year.
a, that the year, yeah. Because I mean, Letang's a borderline Hall of Famer. I think the Oilers have three really good defensemen. I mean, that Mathias Ekholm, Evan Bouchard pairing has been unbelievable. It's since Ekholm was acquired at the trade deadline last year. I mean, their goals for percentage is in the low to mid 60s over the course of a season and a half. So now they benefit from playing predominantly with Connor McDavid on the ice at 5-on-5 in a more kind of offensive role, but they deserve those minutes too. I mean, Ekholm, his offensive game is underrated for being the kind of the staunch defender that people kind of view him as. And then, I mean, Evan Bouchard, I think, is the top, I don't know, five offensive defensemen in the league, whatever you want to, he's certainly in around that area. So I think they have a, if it's not a legitimate top pair throughout the league, it's a 1B or whatever. Darnell Nurse, he gets a lot of flack here. There's the contract that everyone knows about. I don't think he gets enough credit for, taking on, a thankless job of mostly playing against opponents' top lines. Again, mostly doing it without Connor McDavid on the ice. And he's done it with a, you know, up until the last 9, 10, 11 games with Cody Ceci, who is a fine, serviceable NHL defenseman, but I don't know if he's the kind of top four caliber that a lot of people would kind of point to. And more recently, they've had him with Vincent Desharnais, who's just a really nice player who's continually grown. You know, a seventh round pick in 2016, I believe, who's what, 27, 28 years old, very late bloomer who's just played his 100th game. But again, that's, you know, up until then, he'd been a bottom pairing guy and somebody that I think rightly so probably had been pigeonholed in that spot. So that's where I kind of wonder if they are defensemen short. And again, Nurse has to take on a tough role with, you know, with due respect to either Nurse or sorry, with due respect to either CC or Desharnais, kind of shepherding along a you know, a lesser defenseman than obviously either Ekholm or Bouchard. So I think they have three really good defensemen. I don't know if any one of them is like a true number one, certainly like a Makar or Heiskanen or one of those, you know, those types of players, but three really nice, say, number two defensemen. I think that's a really good spot to be in. It's just, you know, I that number four spot is a little bit suspect, which kind of leads to your point of, well, will the offense carry them? Yeah, I think at times the offense is going to have to carry them, but I do think the defense is stronger to the point where they should be able to get the job done against a lot of opponents.
And last year in the playoffs, obviously you alluded to it just now with the defense, but also the goaltending in many ways let them down, especially in that Vegas series. How do you feel about Stuart Skinner being the number one goalie for this team going into the playoffs? Do you feel as though he's really prepared to be that number one guy heading into the playoffs and potentially going deep into the playoffs as well?
Yeah, I mean, I covered junior hockey when Stuart Skinner was in that league, and I saw him win a lot of games for very poor Lethbridge Hurricanes team. I've been a big Stuart Skinner guy. Is he, you know, is he maybe not this year, but Vasilevskiy or
Hellebuck.
Hellebuck or, you know, go down? But no, he's okay. No, he's not. But I quite frankly, I think there are about eight guys, give or take, that you can count on year after year in this league. Like, even look at Marc-Andre Fleury before you know, he's kind of aged out a little bit now, but there were times in the playoffs where, think of that series maybe against Philly, or, you know, 2 years where he was the backup or whatever. Jacob Markstrom's rotated between good and bad years. Look at even Jake Ottinger, who I probably would have put in that eight kind of category, but he's not had a very good year. So goaltending is, if not, it's certainly the most fickle position in hockey. It might be the most fickle position in pro sports, but aside from, you know, maybe pitching in baseball. And no, Stuart Skinner is not in the true elite of the league, but he's certainly in the next tier to me, and there's no reason to think he can't do it. Now, would you like a better safety net in Edmonton? Yeah, maybe. But I mean, they do have Calvin Pickard, who has, you know, coming into this year, I think it was 119 games, and he's been a really nice number three for this team, moving up to number two. Jack Campbell, I know that name kind of will make Oilers fans scream, but really, he's as good of a, you know, number three as you can get. He's played really well in Bakersfield. He came in very capably for 120 minutes, so 2 games worth of time. You know, for Skinner last year, and his save percentage was like 960.
Game
So,
four.
like, let's be real. If any of those circumstances happen, the Oilers are in deep trouble. Like, this team will go as far as Stuart Skinner can carry them. Let's be frank. But I think Skinner is kind of in that second tier of guys that can do just as well as anyone else on any given night. Yeah, if it's going to be the Oilers and Canucks, or Oilers again, Oilers and Jets with, you know, Hellebuck or Demko, you probably think, and rightly so, that Stuart Skinner is the second best goaltender in that series. But Look at what Vegas did. Like Adin Hill was a borderline Conn Smythe trophy guy coming in halfway through the Oilers series and did just fine. All it takes is for a guy like him to get hot. We've seen him get hot for those winning streaks that I mentioned. Can he do it in the playoffs? Sure. Why not? Can he fall flat on his face again? Yeah, that's a real possibility as well, but I kind of lean more toward the former than the latter. I think he's just slowly, gotten better. I think he's had these experiences that maybe haven't gone well that have served him well. And I think the Oilers are in just as good a spot as anyone could be with those second type of goaltenders. So yeah, you'd love to have a complete A guy that is bound for the Hall of Fame, but yeah, Stuart Skinner's 25 or 26, and is headed in the right direction. So, if I'm the Oilers, I feel as confident with him as I do with a lot of goaltenders in the league.
With that, obviously this team has been comprised outside of maybe drafting McDavid and Leon Draisaitl with Ken Holland's fingerprints all over it. It seems as though this is probably his last season as, the head of the Oilers. Just how would you assess his tenure so far? And obviously, if the Oilers win the cup, it's an A++. But just before the playoffs right now, how would you assess his tenure in Edmonton?
Yeah, I mean you're right. I mean it's the we don't know with 100% certainty, but the all the signs are certainly pointing to this being Ken Holland's last year. His contract is up at the end of this year. It's in his late 60s. He's a, like somebody who could work if he wanted to, but I do sense the winds are kind of changing here with Jeff Jackson being hired. Connor McDavid's former agent, same with Sam Gagner and Connor Brown for that matter, being hired here in July or August of last year, and kind of changing the not only the, I would say the I don't want to say the direction of the team, but kind of the underlying kind of nature of the team, where I think they're a lot more analytically focused. They've hired somebody in the analytics department to spear that up. They've hired a lot of data people. I think the new GM, quite frankly, will be somebody that fits in that vein, and I do expect that to come, kind of after the season comes at some point. But Ken Holland, he walked into a very tough spot here in Edmonton. The Peter Chiarelli era, especially the end of it, was not kind. And garbage was kind of piled on top of that very late in the process, where, if you remember,
Hoskins.
they acquired Brandon Manning, who was the guy that broke Connor McDavid's Connor bone. I don't want to go as far as saying intentionally, but there was a lot of animosity at that time, and they went and picked him up. They traded, they went from trading Jordan Eberle for Ryan Strome, and then they traded Ryan Strome for Ryan Spooner, and that trade just kept evolving. And then I think you touched on it there, Alex, but yeah, the day before he was fired, they signed Mikko Koskinen to a 3-year contract when he played 27, 28 games or whatever as an Oiler, and just a couple with the Islanders like 10 years before. So certainly puzzling decision after puzzling decision. And certainly there was the Milan Lucic contract that was 3 years deep at that point. Holland, basically the reason that trade was made was because James Neal could be bought out and Milan Lucic could not, and Neal had a very good start to his first year as an Oiler, and had some injuries, and skating wasn't kept kind of going downhill as he got older. So, but they were able to buy that out with 2 years left on that. I believe 2 years left on that deal, 2 years into it and 2 years left. There was just a lot of mess. Like you look at the roster, and I mean, I can't defend the move, but the reason they signed, or Holland signed, Zach Cassian, just before the pandemic started, was because they had no other right wingers on the team. The right wingers were Kailer Yamamoto, who had been on the team at that point for about a month. Jesse Puljujärvi was in Finland still, And they had like Josh Archibald. And so in retrospect, it ended up being a terrible move because, well, firstly, they pumped up Zach Kassian by playing him with McDavid and Draisaitl, and then immediately started demoting him down the lineup. But the pandemic happened, and the salary cap stayed flat, and that really kind of made the deal way worse than it maybe could have been. But Holland has been like he came into a situation where there were a lot of bad moves made, a lot of hasty moves at the end of Shirelli's tenure. And Holland is a very sensible and conservative GM. In his 5 years as Oilers general manager, he made one in-season trade that wasn't within the week of the trade deadline. And that was getting rid of Alex Stalock for future considerations. So nothing as kind of a personal favor. So he's not a guy that likes to upset the apple cart, even in trying times. But, he did, whether pushed by ownership or what have you, and in this last case, in terms of the coaching changes, he made two of them. The last case this year was clearly a Jeff Jackson move. Chris Knobloch was his guy, but he did do some of that stuff. He had he made some terrible moves, like for sure. The Jack Campbell contract's not good. I mentioned the Cassian one. There's some other kind of lesser moves. He made some pretty good moves too. Zach Hyman is on the short list of best free agent contracts, since the lockout. The trade for Ekholm has done wonders for this defense and the makeup of the team. So those are two really big moves. He signed Ryan Nugent-Hopkins to a discounted move, which also at that time, I mean, Nugent-Hopkins in that 56 game season, I think he had like two primary assists at 5-on-5. So that was a bit of a gamble. But obviously he responded with more than 100 points last year, and certainly a fixture both on the power play and the penalty kill. So that move's worked out well. And has taken some flack from me for signing guys like Evander Kane and Corey Perry. Bringing Jake Virtanen to camp, obviously that didn't materialize into anything, but at various times, those players, Perry and Kane, came in with some baggage, certainly a lot more so in Evander Kane's case. But there's no denying at their peak, and Perry's peak is still very or very very Perry's time rather is still pretty short-lived here, but Evander Kane's peak at least was very, very good. That first year he was an Oiler, scored half a goal pace heading into the playoffs, and scored 13 in 15 playoff games en route to a conference final appearance. So how would I rate Ken Holland's time? It's tough. I mean, you're right. If they win the cup, I mean, we're having a completely different conversation, and that's a basically a couple of bounces in some key games in the playoffs that could change everything. But I'd say probably a good solid B. There's some things I believe he could have done to kind of move the needle a little bit more. But the blunders from past eras have been again, there've been a couple, but not to the anywhere near the same degree that they were under the last regime. So certainly the moves that he has made have paid tremendous dividends. Again, could he have done a little bit more? Yeah, I think he could have, but I think the final grade needs to come after the big test, and that's the spring.
It's like either you fail the 50% exam or
Yeah.
kill it with and get an A plus on it. But I want to ask just quickly about his deadline because he acquired Adam Henrique, Carrick, Stecher as well. Just what do you make of those moves that aren't maybe eye popping, but maybe move the needle in the right direction?
Well, to me, there are two areas that need to be upgraded, or ideally would have been upgraded, and that's again that one I mention a lot, and that's number two right side defenseman, the number four defenseman on the team, and the other one I think they lacked another scorer. Which seems weird for the Oilers to say when you're the Oilers, you have McDavid, you have Draisaitl, led the league in offense last year, best power play in the history of the league last year, still pretty good. But they did la like they were using again, Ryan McLeod and Warren Fogle a lot in their top six. Vander Kane's had some injury issues and struggled. Ryan Nugent-Hopkins logically was going to take a step back in terms of his overall production after getting a 100, 104 points or whatever it was the previous year. So they really could have used somebody there. And then on defense. So we'll start with the forward. And so they were kind of in a tricky spot because they didn't have a lot of cap room. And whoever they brought in was not going to play on the power play. So you really needed a guy that could produce that 5-on-5. And if you brought in somebody making a lot of money, and not, they obviously got retention in some of the deals that they did make, but you're probably going to have to move out Warren Fogle, who again has had a very good year, it's contract year granted, and that is a complication maybe for the offseason. But if he's fourth on the team in 5-on-5 scoring, that guy that they brought in who's not going to play on the power play better be able to uphold that end of the bargain as well. So that made for kind of a tricky, in my from my perspective, kind of a tricky addition that they needed to make. I think they inquired about Jake Guentzel, who is the guy that I thought really could have moved the needle for them. But they didn't have that. If you saw what Carolina gave them, like they didn't have three decent prospects plus a roster player. Because
Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh rather is not going to want Warren Fogle at the end of his contract. Like that doesn't help them even if that was the right move for the Oilers and all that. So that move didn't really kind of materialize or didn't kind of they didn't have the right assets to make that type of move. Plus Holland's never been one to want to give up a lot for a rental. So there are other names to play. I know they were interested in Jordan Eberle. He ultimately signed. Tyler Toffoli was a guy that maybe could have worked. Ultimately went to Winnipeg. There's a few guys, but again, that guy needs to be able to score at 5-on-5. And so, looking at the forward that they did bring in the more top six, top nine guy in Henrique, I like the move because he could play in the top six on the wing. He could play center on the third line, which as much as I'm more of a proponent of Ryan McLeod in that role than some other people, but I think it's good to have a backup or a different look there, and Henrique certainly provides that. Sam Carrick to me is they needed somebody in the fourth center spot. How good is Carrick? I think we're still trying to learn that. Like he won't be in the lineup tonight against Winnipeg. I don't know how much of a true upgrade he is over Derek Ryan per se, but he's another guy brings a different element to the team. Kind of more of a throw in on the Henrique deal. That's totally fine. Now, and we talked about Cody Ceci a lot off the top. That's an area that really could have been ideally addressed. There weren't many guys available though, and they did make a pitch for Chris Tanev. That would have been a very difficult trade to facilitate with Calgary. They've been three trades in their history together with those two teams. Not only that, but others have reported, I believe Elliot Friedman, chief among them, that Calgary or sorry Edmonton wanted to move out a deal as sorry a player in terms of a contract in that type of trade. Logically, that would have been Tanev, who or sorry Cece rather for Tanev, which Cece has another year on his contract, could maybe have been flipped in the summer or the before the deadline next year, but clearly Calgary didn't want to go that route. So the other guy was Sean Walker. This management, and again, I think the winds are changing because there's Jeff Jackson and some analytic people be more analytically inclined, but at least Ken Holland has never been one who's been that interested in having smaller defensemen. He likes big guys, likes rangy guys, and Sean Walker doesn't fit that mold. So it did not surprise me at all that they didn't go down that road, rightly or wrongly. But if you take those two guys out of the equation, I don't know, you might have an answer that I'm not thinking of, but there weren't too many other guys that would have been an appreciable upgrade. So that's why, to me, I kind of we were asked to rate at the Athletic the team's deadline. I gave it an 8 out of 10. Again, I think it's kind of a, without being able to give half grades, probably more like a 7.5. But good solid B. He addressed some things. Maybe could have kind of. It kind of speaks to Holland's tenure as a general manager of this team, where maybe he would have liked a bigger swing. But I think the work he did was fine, was good. People here were incredibly upset and frustrated looking at what Vegas did, of course. And there's obviously the LTIR advantages or disadvantages in some respects that Vegas did have. The Oilers have been a very healthy team all year. Like, they've had Dylan Holloway go on LTIR for a bit. That's it, really. And they've had, other than maybe a game for an illness or little nick up or whatever for a few guys, like, they've had an incredibly healthy team. So they can't store a guy on LTIR and use that space. So no, they didn't get Hanifin. They didn't get Hurdle, who I don't think has even played yet for the Golden Knights. They didn't get Anthony Mantha, but I think they addressed some areas of their team that needed addressing. Not maybe on the back end as much as you'd want, but I think that the team is obviously better positioned heading into coming out of the deadline than they were going into it. And for a team that, again, to that point, and still has the best record in the league from early November onwards, it's hard to be too critical of that, in my opinion. Maybe they play Vegas and they just don't have the horses, but I think they're in good as good a spot as anyone in the Western Conference to get the job done.
And sometimes in the playoffs, it's are you hot at the right time? Are you riding a wave? And the Oilers are one of the best teams in the league, as you said, since November. So they're playing good hockey outside of when they play in Ontario, I guess. And it'll be interesting to see that they get over the hump. As a Jets fan myself, I hope they play in the conference finals but lose. That would be ideal for both of us. But before I let you go, I just want to ask you a bit bigger picture. Just obviously, I'm sure everyone in Edmonton knows the contractual statuses of Leon Draisaitl and Connor McDavid. Leon has 1 year left on his deal after this season. What do you think happens there? Do you think there's an extension? Is it almost like a Matthews type where it's a 4 year deal? Is there an 8 year extension? Does he try to walk to free agency, which I don't think anyone in Oilers land wants to hear? Just what are you hearing, or what do you think will happen there?
Yeah, it's all what Leon wants, right? The team does plan to give him a contract offer on July 1st. I would expect it to be a pretty good one, or else there's no point in making the offer. So it'll be kind of what Draisaitl wants, and I don't profess to know what he's thinking, to be quite honest. If it were me, though, if I'm him, I want an 8-year contract, because by the time it starts, he'll be a couple weeks shy of turning 30, and that 8-year commitment can get him almost to 38, or, well, 37, that point in the season when it would end in June. That's a retirement type of deal, and we all know how his contract was kind of considered a sweetheart deal. It ended up working out that way for the team. There that you'll go back and that ended up being one of the best moves Peter Chiarelli ever made. He got a lot of flack for that, because at the same time, MacKinnon and Pasternak and Scheifele were signing deals for about $2 million less. So the first couple of years, you're thinking, oh man, like, I don't know if, like, it's not that Draisaitl's overpaid, but it was like, ugh, could have got him for less. And then as he started scoring 50 goals and 100 points every year, it's like, well, what more do you want? So we all know, looking at William Nylander's contract extension, looking at Elias Pettersson's contract extension, Draisaitl will make more than both of them, especially if he goes to market. He's got the opportunity to do whatever he wants. So yeah, it'll be a tricky spot for the team. He's been a second fiddle to Connor McDavid for a long time here. They're good buddies. He's in Darnell Nurse's wedding. He's been in Edmonton a long time. I don't, if it weren't a contractual thing, I don't think he certainly hasn't been trying to force his way out the door or anything like that. I think it will depend on who kind of comes calling. If he doesn't sign right away, you might want to think about it and say, if is it a team like LA, is it a team like Boston that clearly lacks a true number one center, and him to kind of be more of the face of a team than he has been, say, in Edmonton. Those are all questions that I can't answer because it kind of depends on what Leon Draisaitl thinks, and he might think he knows the answer now, but if this team does something in the playoffs that's either rubs them the wrong way or inspires him to continue on, or the contract offer that the team's going to give him, might be too much for him to pass up. So there's a lot of factors at play. If I'm the Oilers and he doesn't sign, though, a lot of people here think they should trade him. I'd be more inclined to let them run it back with him as a guy that, I mean, would be super motivated to do well in a contract year, but it could be the best chance this team ever has, if they don't win this year, to win the Stanley Cup. That, he could walk out the door for nothing because he almost certainly wouldn't be trading him at the deadline in that situation. But you do get his cap space, and you can kind of do what you want with his cap space to fill out your roster. That's a risky move. It's also would then be a year before Connor McDavid has the opportunity to hit the market. But I'd be more inclined to do that. Call me crazy. I might have a different answer for you in a few months if I think about things a little bit differently. But that's how I'd be more inclined to want to operate right now. Yeah, it could be the wrong thing. We saw what happened in Calgary with, Johnny Gaudreau, to a different extent, and going back further with like John Tavares on the island. But I think this team is in a better spot than those two teams were. And this is their window. Like, this is their cup window. This is why they signed Zach Hyman. This is why they acquired Matias Ekholm. Why they have all these other guys on long-term contracts. So to me, it would be a little short-sighted to I don't know if that's even the right word, but it wouldn't behoove them to move Draisaitl if you're trying to win. And I think this year next is their time, and you got to keep one of the better players in the league, one of the better offensive players in the league anyway, to try to get over the hump.
What would your contract offer be to Leon Draisaitl in terms of maybe money wise? Because some would say he might be asking for more than Matthews. More than McKinnon being the highest paid.
Yeah, I mean, he can ask for anything he wants. There's a real risk from the team's perspective to going to 8 years. He's been incredibly healthy. He's missed like single digits in his entire career after that rookie year when he was sent back to like scratched a bit and sent down to junior. Been a really healthy player. Played through injuries like in the playoffs a couple years
Yep,
ago.
2 years.
But he's also is a big body who is not as graceful a skater as Connor McDavid and few are, but could that contract age poorly? Yeah, I could. But again, if so that's a tough one. If I'm him again, though, I'm going for 8 years. And I think the like Peterson was 12.
It was
12.
11, I
Peterson
think
and
it was
Nylander.
11-6, I think, and then
Okay.
Willie was 11-5 for 8 years.
Okay. So, I mean, I did a story when Nylander signed saying that he could, with an agent telling me he could command, 12, 5, or 13. It's probably
That makes sense.
what it would have to be. And then you got to go to Connor a year later and say, okay, you're going for. I mean, McDavid's at 12.5, and he could have signed for more, and he will sign for more next time. So, but
16.
the cap's going up. They're gonna have some money coming off the books later on. I don't know. I'm 100% signing McDavid to whatever the heck he wants. But Draisaitl, it's a little bit trickier for all involved. It's a really, really tricky one. So. I don't have the perfect answer for you, but I know he can. He can command more than Nylander and Pettersson. So.
Well, I hope for, your sake that they maybe go deep and he feels convinced to stay in Edmonton because I always love to see the Canadian teams do well, and I think it's so much fun to watch him and McDavid cook together as I did on Sunday. So I hope he stays for 8 years and gets everything he wants. And then same goes to Connor McDavid, but only time will tell. Before I let you go, just I know I think I did this last time when I had you on in terms of predictions. I'm sure it's you never really know. It's too early, but I think it's always a fun little thing to do. So what's your Stanley Cup pick right now as we speak here in late March?
I mean, I feel like it changes given the day. I think my money has got to be on Edmonton coming out of the West because, Vancouver's still a team that, hasn't really been there much, and teams don't typically glide through. Winnipeg to me kind of came out of nowhere, although I do kind of like the way that the team's kind of filled out. Dallas, I like, but Ottinger's a huge question mark. I could totally see another Edmonton Colorado conference final, which would be a lot of fun. I feel like it's Edmonton's time. It's Edmonton's time. In the East, it's probably got to be Florida. I feel like the best team. They seem like the best team out there. They went to the final last year, so that could maybe have drained them a little bit. But the regular season would prove otherwise. So Edmonton, Florida, which would be atrocious for travel reasons,
Oh my God.
but a fun series, and for that it's probably a pick 'em. So I'll say Edmonton and Florida. That's about
Okay.
as best I could
I
do.
love it. I think that would be a lot of fun. It would be very different ice surfaces, one in the heat and one in the cold up in Edmonton, even in June, I guess, but would be a fun one. And I think seeing Matthew Tkachuk join at Connor McDavid would be worth a lot of money. And then Nick Cousins coming around the corner. So, thanks so much for doing this, Daniel. Is there anything that you want to plug, just for what you have up coming up at the Athletic and people should, stay tuned for?
Not necessarily, just trying to knock out a few stories before the playoffs that I think should be fun. I got to kind of get to work and finish off a few things, but just kind of keep following along on the on my you know the, my author page at The Athletic and Twitter at DNB Sports. And I think you'll hopefully find something in the next 2, 3 weeks that you'll like to read.
Well, I always do, and I really appreciate you taking the time and doing this. And I know for you, I hope they go deep in the playoffs, but if they don't, I hope you have a great summer with your family. And thanks so much for taking the time and doing this, Daniel.
Oh, you're welcome, Alex. A pleasure being on with you again.